Hi, everybody. This is Pam coming to you from the debut episode of a new addition to the blog, Make Room for the Stuttering. Today, I'm going to introduce his stories. She asks him. And my goal is to introduce a little bit of the male perspective on this crazy thing that we all know as stuttering. So for my debut male guest, I'm really excited to say hello to Alan. Hi, Alan. How are you?
Good afternoon. It's good afternoon here in Wales in the United Kingdom. I suspect it's still morning with you or just into the afternoon in the New York area.
That is correct. It's just past noon time, and it's a beautiful Saturday afternoon here. Kind of chilly, but it's one of those days where I don't mind at all staying in, talking with good friends, and probably later on getting some housework done.
Good for you.
So, Alan, for our listeners, could you formally introduce yourself, your name, and again, where you're from, and what you do with yourself these days?
I will introduce myself, even though, as you know, I'm a shy and retiring guy. My name is Alan Badminton, and I'll spell that because everybody spells it incorrectly. Badmington. Everybody leaves out the G.
Oh.
And I'm from Wales in the United Kingdom. And Wales, just to give you a brief geographical lesson, Wales is one of the four countries that make up the United Kingdom, along with England, Scotland, and Northern Ireland. And so I live in Wales. I've always lived in Wales, and I've lived here for quite a long time because I'm getting quite long in the tooth.
Okay.
And I've stuttered. I'm so sorry I interrupted you. I was just going to say I've stuttered since the very early age of 3.
And you speak obviously very clearly and very fluidly as we're hearing you. You've stuttered since the age of 3. So what type of strategies, techniques have you employed over the years to attain the eloquence that I'm hearing from you now?
You don't have long enough in this podcast for me to outline all the different things that I've tried. I had speech therapy when I was very young. That didn't work. I got by in school, and it was only really when I went to the grammar school at the age of 11. And I have vivid memories of struggling to give my name and address at the initial registration, and reading aloud in class was a nightmare. And as the reading would be going around the room, I would be scanning ahead, 10 desks ahead, to check the words that I thought I was going to have to say. And I would realize that there were many, many in the passages that I could not say, and I would opt out. So that's my school. I never asked nor responded to questions in class for fear of looking a fool. I knew the answers. I wanted to participate, but I kept my mouth shut. It was so frustrating. Moving on through adolescence, I didn't have any further speech therapy. And then, at the age of 19, when my hair was dark and I didn't have a wrinkle in sight, I did something that most people would consider idiotic for someone with a stutter, a severe stutter, because it was that severe that I couldn't say 13 letters of the alphabet. And worse of all, of course, I couldn't say letters B, which was a problem because my name was, and believe it or not, it still is Badminton. But there was B, C, D, F, G, K, L, M, N, P, S, T, and V. I never, ever, ever used. And I became an expert at providing synonyms, words meaning the same but commencing with a different letter. I became a walking thesaurus. But when I joined the police service, the only way in which I was able to gain acceptance was during the interview. I very carefully selected the words that I knew I could say. And I answered, and I didn't display a great deal of stuttering because I was using avoidance techniques. And I was accepted.
What made you want to get into police service, knowing that you likely would have difficulty with communicating?
From a very early age, Pam, I realized that there were many ways that I could live my life. I knew that I could take a relatively easy passage by avoiding social interaction, by avoiding employment that didn't require a great deal of speaking, because as you and I and many others who will listen to this podcast will know, it is so easy to overcome stuttering. Yes, it is, by not speaking. But what good is that? And so I decided that I needed to challenge myself. I needed to place myself in a position where I had contact with the public. And that is why I decided to join the police at the age of 19.
Were you successful?
I was accepted. And of course, in the beginning, you have to go out onto foot patrol, street duties, operational work. And I relied so heavily on word substitution. If someone wanted to know the time, I'd show them my watch. If they wanted directions, I'd draw them on a piece of paper, and I would use word substitution at all times. But as you know, every time you avoid a word, a letter, or a situation, the fear level grows and grows and grows. And I hid for so long. But the time finally came when I had to say a particular word. I had to speak in a particular situation. And the crunch, oh my gosh, I can remember it so clearly. The crunch came for me, Pam, when I had to give evidence in court for the very first time. And I can remember it as clearly as though it were yesterday. It's making me sweat now. I'm beginning to perspire recounting that experience. And I walked into the courtroom as a fresh-faced 19-year-old with every eye upon me. And I stepped up into the wooden witness box. I placed my left hand on the Bible. I raised my right hand in the air and I said, And that's as far as I got, because the oath comprised 23 words. And I knew well in advance that there were 19 I couldn't say. And so I was filled with fear and trepidation in the weeks leading up to that court appearance. And I stuttered so badly that the only way in which I could say the oath was for the clerk of the court to repeat the oath, to say the oath, first of all, and then ask me, and I would say, I do. That's all I had to say was, I do. It was a struggle. But there's worse to come. When you give evidence in court, you don't just give the oath. Then came the evidence in chief. And you can't, and I relied so heavily on word substitution. But you can't change the defendant's name. You can't change the date, the time, the place of the offense. You can't change the registration number, the registration mark, the make of the motor vehicle. They're all non-negotiable. When I found a drunk lying in Somerset Street, for example, it was a huge temptation, Pam, to drag him around into the adjoining street before I made the arrest, into a street which didn't start with one of my feared letters. And I'm sure it won't go any further than this conversation, but I did that on many, many occasions. It was the only way in which I could exist. And the problems I had in court were so bad that a senior officer wrote of me, and I've still got this report to this very day. He said, when this officer gives evidence in court, he is an embarrassment to all. And I've still got that report all these years later. But even worse than that, a couple of years later, he also wrote, the only reason that this officer is not being considered for promotion is his speech impediment. And when I was a very young police officer, I passed the promotion examination and I came third in the whole of England and Wales, which would have qualified me to be considered for a place at the prestigious police college, which would have rocketed me up through the ranks. I went for an interview and they wouldn't accept me because of my speech. And so as a result of that, they moved me indoors. They took me away from operational duties where I was an embarrassment, and they put me in an administrative role for many, many years.
Why did you stay on? Why did you, you know, put up with that?
It was a reasonably well-paid job. I had enjoyed what I was doing. I had made many friends. I was living in accommodation which was being provided by the police authority. There was a lot to give up if I had. The chief, in all fairness, the chief officer of police did call me in at one point and tell me that he would never promote me, or he gave me the option to seek employment elsewhere because he recognized that I had qualities which I could use perhaps in another profession. But I chose to stay, and as you will hear as my interview progresses, it proved worthwhile.
So what was the reaction of your colleagues once it became evident that you were a stutterer because you had avoided it for so long, and especially during the interview. We know now how your superiors reacted, but what was it like with your colleagues and your co-workers? Were they supportive?
Absolutely supportive. I never heard an adverse comment from any of my colleagues or immediate supervisors. It was the people higher up who were not working with me every day. And when I spoke to them, my speech was worse because I was trying harder. I was trying not to stutter in front of them. I know that's the wrong thing now, Pam, but I didn't know anything about stuttering until 10 years ago. I knew nothing about stuttering. I progressed through my life, making my own way, trying various therapies and approaches. And in the end, they all came together like a jigsaw. And whatever treatment or therapy we receive, I believe that we can take something from it and move on. Even though it might not be successful, you can take something. And that's what I did. And I tried lots of things. And one of the things which I utilized for many years, and it's going back a long time now, I acquired a small mechanical device called the Edinburgh Masker. It's not available now. It's not available. It was one of the very early prosthetic devices. And it worked on the principle that if you can't hear your own voice, there's a less likelihood that you will stutter. And so every morning, I had to stick an adhesive throat microphone underneath my Adam's apple. I could never ever wear an open neck shirt at any time of the year. And every time I spoke, an impulse went down a tube into a control box, which I wore concealed beneath my shirt. And that sent a horrendous buzzing sound up tubes and wires, which went through my hair into ear molds, and I had to wear my hair longer than regulation length too high to conceal that contraption. And so every time that I spoke, all I heard was buzz, buzz, buzz. If someone spoke when I was speaking, I couldn't hear them. And so I had to become very adept at lip reading. But it's very difficult to lip read someone at the end of the telephone 100 miles away. And it was horrendous, absolutely horrendous. And I wore that device. This is going to surprise you. I wore that device for 10, 12, 14 hours every day for the next 20 years, Pam. 20 years I didn't hear myself speak when I was wearing that infernal device. It brings tears to my eyes now thinking about it, because I had headaches. I had ear infections. Oh, it was a monstrosity. But you're going to ask me, why did I persevere? Are you going to ask me that?
Well, actually, my first question was, how much would you estimate that you spent all toll on all the different devices, techniques, and therapy approaches that you attempted in the chase to find fluency?
More than half a century. Way more than half a century, Bam.
How much money?
Well, that's a very good question, because in the United Kingdom, as you know, speech therapy is free of charge. It's free of charge. However, I only had speech therapy when I was young. I purchased the Edinburgh masker out of my own pocket, and that was in 1977. And in those days, it cost about how can I translate to currency which you will understand? It was about £150, which was just slightly more then than $200. Today, that would be in the thousands and thousands, because that was 1977.
Yeah. But okay. So the next question, why?
Strange. It never made me fluent, but I tell you what it did. Under the umbrella of that horrific masking sound, it somehow gave me the confidence to go out into the world and speaking situations that I know I would otherwise have avoided. It allowed me to gain very useful interpersonal skills, which sadly many people who stutter don't possess, and the reason they don't possess them, it's not their fault. They remain, many of them, on the fringes of conversation throughout their life, whereas fluent people, if you want to use that expression, acquire these skills from a very, very early age. I'm not speaking about fluency. I'm talking about the art of conversation. And I acquired those skills. And after about, let me see, after about 5 years of wearing that device, I persuaded my employers to allow me to return to operational duties. And I went back out onto operational duties, and I carried out normal duties, and I remained on operational duties until I eventually retired. But
and you mean operational duties, meaning you were back out on the street?
I was back out on the street. I was taking charge of major crime scenes. That became my role. If there was a murder, if there was an arson, if there was a rape, my department took charge of that crime scene. And as a result of attending those major crime scenes, I had to liaise with the forensic science service, with the police surgeon, with the fire service, with all different agencies. And I was able to do it, albeit in a strange way. And what I mean in a strange way, I had to talk rather strangely to like that to keep the device working. It may have sounded strange, but at least I had the means of conversing with other people.
Did anybody ever remark that you sounded strange, or why did you talk like that?
Well, not only did I talk in a kind of strange way, but because I was wearing this device and people couldn't, I couldn't hear people when they spoke, they thought I was hard of hearing as well. They thought I had hearing impairment.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. I know, it was one heck of a struggle, but I put myself out there. I expanded my comfort zones as best I could, but I still relied so heavily on word substitution. I did, because at that time, Pam, I didn't realize the implications of changing the words around. No one had ever told me that every time I changed a word, my fear of that word grew, it grew and grew. If someone had explained that to me when I was younger, I would have made a special effort, even though I may have stuttered more, but I would have said those words then. I did this now in my later life when I learned about the implications of avoidance, but no one told me that until 11 years ago.
So it sounds like you had some type of an aha moment, or, you know, 11 years ago there was something significant that happened to change your mindset. For the sake of brevity,
yes.
Tell us about it, but in a brief fashion.
In a brief fashion. I'd given up. I'd had a car accident. I had whiplash injuries. I couldn't wear that device whatsoever. My speech plummeted. I didn't want to speak to anybody, and if I was walking up the street and I saw someone I knew, I would probably cross over. I vowed that I would never again place myself, I would never again undertake any kind of therapy or approach, because over the years I'd been given reasonable degrees of fluency in a controlled environment. And then when I'd gone back out into the outside world, I'd had them cruelly snatched away. And so I said, never again will I undertake any future treatment. But it all changed very, very briefly. In April 2000, my wife spotted a notice in a shop window advertising a stuttering management program. I'd never heard of it. I wasn't interested. I wasn't going to attend. But she very craftily arranged for us to be passing a building where this program was holding an open day. And we drove into the car park, and she dragged me screaming and kicking into this hall, where I saw people who had been through the program. I heard them speak. They spoke about what it was like before and afterwards. And I was very impressed. And as a result of that, have I got time very quickly to explain to you what changed my mind?
Yes,
very,
please.
Very quickly?
Yes, right. Please.
I don't know how many people who will be listening to this podcast will have heard about the British athlete Roger Bannister. Now, you're probably too young to remember him, Pam, but in 1954, Roger Bannister was the first person ever to run the mile in less than 4 minutes. Prior to that date, athletes worldwide had been attempting to achieve that feat. It was considered impossible. Well, in May 1954, he ran the first sub-4-minute mile. The mindset of athletes changed worldwide. They had evidence that it could be achieved. Within a year, 37 other athletes ran sub-4-minute miles. Mm-hmm. The following year, it increased to more than 300. Well, one person that I heard speaking at that stuttering management open day, he had spoken about how he had won public speaking competitions, and he was so in control of his speech, and he was the person who convinced me that I could do something about my speech. He became my Roger Bannister, and for the first time in my life, I believed that I could do something about my speech. That was April 2000. In May, I attended my very first course, and attending that course gave me physiological tools, or rather tools to deal with the physiological blips that were occurring. Literally within days, because I had previously done work on my life because I had done many things, because I had expanded comfort zones, I was ready. And within days, literally within days, I was standing up and I was in control of my speech for the very first time in my life. And I learned on the first day of that course the implications of avoidance. And I made a pact with myself, Pam, that I would never again avoid any word, letter, sound, or situation. And I can put my hand on my heart and say, in more than 11 years, I haven't avoided one letter, one sound, or one situation. And that has been a tremendous asset in helping me to come to terms with my stuttering issues.
So what was it actually? I mean, what was it that worked? Was it just the change of mindset? Was it just purely facing your greatest fears?
On that course, they drilled certain techniques. I learned a new method of breathing, which virtually helped me to overcome the speech block overnight. I then learned ways of dealing with those 13 letters which had always given me so many problems. And so that course wasn't the be-all and end-all. It wasn't the final destination. It was the springboard, because I now knew that I could have control of my speech. And so I went away from that course, and what I did, I devised my own plan of action. I drew up a plan of action where I challenged myself, I expanded my comfort zones every day from the moment I got up in the morning until the moment I went to bed at night. I joined a public speaking club. No, I tell a lie. I joined 3 public speaking clubs. 3. I would travel 100 miles to a public speaking club just to practice my new techniques, my new control. I would pluck 3 phone numbers from yellow pages. I would call them for 2 to 3 hours a day, making fictitious inquiries. All I wanted to do was to talk, and I was doing it at somebody else's expense.
You're a smart man, Alan.
But no, I identified my self-limiting beliefs, and I challenged those beliefs on a daily basis, because what we believe and how we see ourselves influences our thoughts, and what we think shapes our behaviors. So if you identify your self-limiting beliefs, if you challenge them, or I challenge them, I acquired more empowering beliefs. My thoughts became more empowering. My self-image, our self-image sets the boundaries to our accomplishments. It creates the scripts by which we act out our lives. So it all depends on how you see yourself. If you can change your self-image, make it more empowering, enlarge it, embrace these new roles. And the more I did these new roles, I became more comfortable in doing them. And now I fully accept many, many roles that for so many years lay outside my scope because I thought I couldn't do them.
It almost seems to me that you're a completely different person than you once were. Is that a fair presumption?
I've always been a happy, jokey, outgoing individual, even though I stuttered. But I was wearing shackles. I was wearing shackles. Some people now say I talk too much, Pam, to a charge a charge to which I willingly plead guilty, but I have waited for more than 50 years to be able to say exactly what I want to say. The debilitating oral shackles that inhibited me since childhood have finally been removed, and I can pluck whatever words I choose from the extremities of my vocabulary and say them without the fear of stuttering. There's no fear. I still get the occasional, very occasional reminder, but they are few and far between. And yes, I am a much more assertive individual. You have to become, I believe, more assertive. But the danger, if that is the word, that when we become more assertive, when we change, the people with whom we live, our partners, our wives, our husband, now see, are now living with a different human being. They are not the people that they possibly fell in love with. And the roles which we have, or the roles which I had when I stuttered, they changed. There were many instances where my wife would help out, make telephone calls on my behalf, order for me at a restaurant. The moment I came home from that course on the 4th of May 2000, I explained to her, "Thank you for everything that you have done. Thank you for all the support that you've given me over the years. But please, from now on, I must accept responsibility for every speaking situation that I have to perform." If I hadn't explained, she may have felt a little redundant. She was so, so understanding. We have a wonderful, wonderful relationship. But I have seen people change and have problems with their relationships.
Mm-hmm. Because change changes everything.
You're not the person. The roles which you have fulfilled, the boundaries, the guidelines, they change.
Mm-hmm.
And so you need to consult, you need to share, you need to speak. Otherwise, I know from other people that it has caused them problems. Thankfully, it hasn't caused any problems in our household whatsoever, because my wife has been so, so supportive. And I just like to say, she didn't twist my arm to go on that course because she didn't love me as I was. She did that because she knew that I had had to accept second best for so much of my life, and she knew that I would be happier fulfilling my true potential, and that is why she coaxed me to attend that course in 2000.
Sounds like it was the very best thing that the very best gift that she gave you.
Yes, but I had to move on from that course. Although that course provided wonderful support, I took that support for a while, but I knew that if I really wanted to deal wholly with my stuttering issues, not just in a course environment, not just at a support group. I knew that I had to take responsibility for the rest of my life, and so I have moved away from that course in recent years. But the support which it provided is wonderful, but I chose to move on.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, just to stray a little bit away. With your very fluent communication these days, what's it like for you when you interact or speak with other people who stutter, who have not achieved that level of confidence and fluency? Does it make you uncomfortable to listen to other people that are still stuttering? Does it make you want to suggest to them that they try some of the techniques that have worked for you?
No, I recognize that we are all different human beings. We commence from different starting lines. We have different life experiences. We have different amounts of emotional baggage. We have different aspirations and hopes in life. I would never, ever, ever, ever attempt to coerce anyone to follow in my footpath. It worked for me. It worked for me. I would never, ever dream of telling anyone, hey, you should do this. No, no, no. I will willingly share my experiences as I am here. I still belong to the International Telephone Support Network, which is provided by that stuttering management program. Although I no longer attend their courses, I no longer attend their support groups, I still support people who are coming through via that international support network. And I speak every day to 10, 12, 15. I have spoken to as many as 30 different people on one day. It's all done completely free of charge without... I do it because I received that help when I needed it. No, I speak to people who still stutter very severely every day. It doesn't register with me whatsoever. I was in that position myself not so long ago. Why should I look down on them? It's just how they speak.
Mm-hmm. And I wasn't suggesting that you would look down on anybody else who has not achieved the fluency that you have. Certainly that's not what I was suggesting. I was trying to find out if, you know, sometimes it might seem natural, like, to just say to somebody, hey, try this, it worked for me, you know. And it sounds like, you know, you share your story, but you share it with just an interest in sharing for the sake of sharing, and not necessarily suggesting, or as you put, coercing anybody to try something. Because you're right, I mean, we're all unique, and what works for one perhaps will not work for another. And there is no cookie cutter approach to take with this thing that we deal with known as stuttering.
There are people who have improved their fluency, who try to coerce others. I know that it can cause friction. Mm. I would never, ever, I have never done that, and I would never, ever, ever consider doing it in my lifetime.
Mm. Well, that's, you know, that's important because, you know, the stuttering community is vast, and we're all so different, and each of our unique stories contributes to the community that we can take a little bit from here, a little bit from there. And I just firmly believe that just simply sharing our stories with each other makes a big difference. Would you agree?
Yes. Over the last 10 years, I have spoken to more than 400 different organizations in an attempt to create greater public awareness about stuttering. The majority of those groups are not people who stutter. But there are always people in those groups who come to me at the end of my talk or even stand up when I conduct the question and answers at the end, and they say, what you have spoken about, identifying your self-limiting beliefs, expanding your comfort zones, facing your fears, living life to the full, that applies to everyone. And they tell me that they are heartened and inspired by what I speak about, because it doesn't just relate to people who stutter. I've spoken to people who are hard of hearing. I've spoken to people who have Parkinson's disease. I have spoken to people who have cancer, and they all tell me the same, that dealing with stuttering is very much like dealing with problems which other people have in their lives. Although I know and I fully understand that that may be difficult for people who stutter to understand that other people have very similar issues in their lives.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, other people have more serious debilitating issues than stuttering.
Yes, they have. Mm-hmm. Hey, I was hoping you were going to ask me to recite the poem which explains to people the implications of avoidance, because I think it is so important, and I never ever had this when I was younger. And so if there is time, please, 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 Pam, I'm on my knees pleading with you. If there is time, could I share it with others?
I'll make you a deal. We'll do that at the end, and we are approaching the end. But I did want to ask you, you asked me at one time, could you be an honorary woman on my podcast?
I beg your pardon.
You asked me. You did.
Yes.
You...
yes, we did. I did say it.
And I'm curious, why did you want to come on to, you know, have a conversation with me that would be publicized? What was the draw?
One, I love challenges. I still set myself goals every day. The most bizarre challenge, the greater the satisfaction I derive. So it was expanding my comfort zones. It was a new challenge. Two, I like having the opportunity to share my story. not to say to people, hey, this is what I have done. I truly believe that when we share our stories, there may be people out there who may pick up on even one small aspect of what the person has to say, and that may be sufficient to help them to progress a little bit further. And another thing is, I truly believe that speaking about our own experiences is not in any way egotistical. I truly believe that when we bring these positive experiences back into our minds, it strengthens our memories of those experiences. And for so long, I had so many negative experiences, and I replayed those negative outlooks over and over. So now I've reversed it. The worm has turned. I now remind myself of the things that I have achieved in life. And if along the way someone takes just one little point or two little points from that journey, then it would make it, for me, all worthwhile.
Thank you for sharing that. And to wrap up this great conversation, please do share your poem with us.
It's a poem entitled Changing the Words Around, and you've guessed it's by Alan Badminton. I couldn't say muffin. I couldn't say butter. If I ordered a burger, I'd stumble and stutter. So instead of me saying the words that I should, I'd swap them for others I hoped that I could. But you can't always leave out the words that you dread. There are times when a certain thing has to be said. My sister's called Sarah. My best friend is Ben. They just wouldn't answer to Lucy and Len. Whenever I spotted a difficult sound, I'd hastily juggle my sentence around. I spent so much energy word rearranging. Whenever I spoke, I was chopping and changing. My efforts to search for an easier word resulted in sentences sometimes absurd. At times, my selections just didn't make sense, which made me more anxious, frustrated, and tense. Each time I avoided a troublesome sound, I felt rather guilty and very soon found that my fear of speaking increased even more. The number of problem words started to soar. In time, I discovered that word substitution was simply avoidance and not a solution. Although I was fluent, or so it appeared, the words I avoided became much more feared. One day, I decided enough was enough. I made myself promise, although it was tough, to say what I wanted, whatever the letter. At times I still struggled, but I felt so much better. Today, I will say any letter or sound. Confronting my fears is the best way I've found. Should I ever be tempted to waver some time, I'll remember the message contained in this rhyme. And that's it, Pam.
Oh, that was beautiful. And that was a perfect way to end this wonderful conversation that we've had. I want to thank you for sharing and being a guest on this inaugural episode. Again, thank you for your honesty and your willingness to share your story.
Thank you for allowing me to go boldly where no man has previously gone.
Oh, perfect. And this has been His Stories, She Asks Him.